This is Storage Unpacked. Subscribe at storageunpacked.com.
Hi, this is Chris Evans with another Storage Unpacked podcast. I'm here with Martin again. How are you doing, Martin?
Yeah, not too bad. How are you?
Pretty good. All settled in for working from home, I think, now, you know.
Yeah, I think like the rest of the globe. Yeah.
Yes, like the rest of the globe, exactly. Absolutely. We're all getting very much used to it. So this week we have a guest. Very pleased to say that we have a returning guest. We've got Alex Kirkup from StorageOS. Hi, Alex. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. And hi, Chris and Martin. And yes, we're all working from home as well at StorageOS, as is, I imagine, the vast majority of the world today.
And I would imagine the vast majority of people who are listening to us as well.
Yes, indeed.
So we were going to talk at KubeCon, which was due to be held, in fact, this week in Amsterdam. Funny enough, I would have been on a flight today, as I'm sure you would have been, if not yesterday or the day before, but we haven't been able to do that. So we're doing this remotely rather than face-to-face. And we're going to take some time to talk about your storage platform and version 2, which is coming out.
Yes, that's right. It's a bit sad that KubeCon had to get postponed. It's now potentially postponed until August, or might become a virtual event. We were looking forward to KubeCon because it's a great opportunity to talk to so many people in the community. And I kind of have two hats because I'm the CEO of StorageOS, but I am also the co-chair of the CNCF Storage SIG. And so these sort of events are great opportunities to work with the different teams from lots of different vendors and independent developers.
Yeah, let's make the best of it. Let's get into the technology. Oh, by the way, in case anybody hasn't made the connection, you have been on the podcast before. It was actually 2 years ago, just over 2 years ago, when we were talking about Spectre and Meltdown, the processor bugs. So we've had a discussion before, but we're not going to go down into that today. We're going to talk about your storage platform and exactly what it is and what it does for people. So could you start by just giving us a bit of a background as to what StorageOS is, what the platform does, and what people would use it for?
Sure. So StorageOS is a storage-defined cloud-native storage platform. So the idea behind this is that it gives end users the ability to have enterprise storage class functionality deployed in a platform agnostic way. Our product is actually deployed as a container, which means it's infrastructure agnostic, and it provides availability and performance and security to run stateful workloads at scale. The reason why this is important is because no application is effectively stateless, right? Despite the mantra about containers being stateless. And what we find is that, you know, end users kind of go through a journey where they deploy, where they convert some of their applications to containers, because this gives them the portability and it removes the dependencies and means that the app is now decoupled from physical server requirements. And then they look at products like Kubernetes to automate and to manage the environment and provide things like scaling and self-healing. And then the obvious question is, you know, how do you deal with those stateful applications? So in dynamically formed clusters where nodes come and go and nodes are getting upgraded and nodes scale on demand, how do you deal with the storage requirements? And this is where StorageOS comes in. So we're deployed as a container, we virtualize storage within the cluster, and we provide dynamic provisioning to those stateful applications, which could be anything from databases to message queues to streaming systems like Kafka, and even more recently, things like VMs with projects like KubeVirt.
Okay, that's brilliant. So that gives us a bit of an introduction there. Now, I'm really interested in this idea of building storage, which we typically see as persistent, out of containers, which we typically think of as not being persistent. But there's no reason to say you can't do that, because clearly there is persistence built in there somewhere, because you still have to sit that environment on some sort of physical storage at the bottom of it somewhere.
That's right. So in a container, the data is typically ephemeral. What we do with StorageOS is we virtualize the storage that's available on each of the nodes within a cluster. So potentially that could be physical disk in the case of bare metal boxes, or say virtual disk in the case of VMs, or even say cloud disk if you're running this in the cloud. And we create this pool of storage that spans the entire cluster. And from there, you can dynamically provision StorageOS volumes. And those StorageOS volumes are now portable and linked to a container. So those volumes get imported into what's called the namespace of the container. And this means that those applications, say a MySQL database perhaps, or something like Kafka, for example, can now access that storage. And if the container moves between nodes, they continue to access the same storage as it moves around the nodes with them.
Okay, and obviously you're adding things like data protection, resilience, and other things in there to make sure that data is secure if things like nodes go down, containers go down, and so on. Because one of the things with any container environment is we assume that containers can go away and come back again.
So that's right. Indeed, one of the key things is, you know, that a lot of the patterns that we see in typical enterprise applications means that they typically have a strong dependency on availability at the storage layer. So we do things like replicate the data across multiple nodes to make sure that your data is safe even if a node is lost or a disk is lost. We do things like encryption so that data is encrypted both in transit and while it's at rest on disk. And we implement a number of data services to mean that these services are available across the cluster, transparent to the application. Because exactly as you said, nodes do come and go, but also containers can be stopped and moved to other nodes through the use of the orchestrator.
Okay, Martin, from your perspective, you know, how do you view it? This is quite a difference, isn't it, from what people have been used to in terms of traditional storage?
We've had these interesting clashing cultures between the traditional enterprise and containers, where containers first came along, they always thought about ephemeral, and everybody in the enterprise turned around and said, actually, well, most of our data isn't ephemeral. We need to make sure it's kept and we need to be protected. We need consistency. So there has always been a bit of debate about transactional consistency and integrity. So I'm seeing things like StorageOS becoming very important because it fixes some of these problems to enable enterprises and larger users to use containers.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I just want to sort of dig into a couple of bits of the technical side here, Alex. Not too deep, but just, you know, try and understand some of this for people who might not be able to sort of judge the context of the idea of having a set of containers and storage within that mapping to a set of containers. I assume, obviously, you can take advantage of, for example, mapping the container that's accessing the storage against the container that's actually running on the node itself to a certain degree, almost like, I guess, what you might call an affinity with that application container. That must be one aspect to this. And the other aspect I was just going to say was that one of the things we see with physical storage is that as you try and balance this idea of containers moving around between nodes and physical storage, you've got to somehow map a physical array to all the different nodes that could possibly access the container. So you end up with a much more complex model. So I'd imagine you're offering both simplification, but you can actually tie that performance to a local container as part of that too.
So that's worth discussing. So there's two things there. One is the concept of dynamic provisioning. So in much the same way that a developer can say to Kubernetes, hey, this is my application, it needs to run these containers, and it needs this amount of RAM and this amount of CPU, and perhaps this amount, this connectivity on the network. And Kubernetes kind of plays this awesome game of Tetris with all of your apps and manages to deploy it to use the best configuration of the underlying infrastructure. So in much the same way, we simplify this at the storage layer too, because in exactly the same way that you want to be able to specify something as simple as CPU and memory, you also want to specify, for example, that your database or that your application needs this amount of storage. Let's say it needs 100 gig of storage and it needs to be protected and it needs to be encrypted, etc. And what we'll do behind the scenes is we intercept those requests, typically using CSI, which is the container storage interface, which is a standardized API between Kubernetes and storage providers. And we dynamically provision those volumes and connect them up to the containers. Now, when we talk about sort of data placement, again, we kind of see an evolution as customers deploy these sort of technologies. In the simplest form, we have, you know, the concept of hyperconverged, where every node is both running applications and also providing and consuming storage out of a storage pool. And then due to you know, commercial, technical, or operational reasons, a lot of users also end up with some sort of hybrid model where some nodes are hyperconverged and some nodes are compute only and some nodes are storage only. But then what we also see is that they quickly move on to more advanced workloads. So both in the case of, there are two sort of examples here. One is the concept of data locality. So we've developed a system that integrates with the Kubernetes orchestrator and effectively helps score workloads such that a workload can be placed where the data physically is within a Kubernetes cluster. And this gives huge benefits. I mean, you know, the obvious reason being that you're not going out over the network to access data. For the most part, you're accessing data locally, and that gives dramatic improvements on latency, which in simple terms means you do more transactions per second and your application runs faster. But also, we're seeing more complex workloads. So things like Elasticsearch, Kafka, Cassandra, for example, apart from locality requirements, they also require affinity or anti-affinity on where the volumes are placed. So for example, if you have a three-node Elasticsearch cluster, you want to make sure that the data is actually doesn't all land on the same node. The data is actually spread out across the Elasticsearch cluster instances. And similarly, also, if you're deploying for high availability, you may want to use anti-affinity placements to make sure that data is placed across data center racks or perhaps across availability zones in the cloud.
Okay, now you mentioned Kubernetes a lot, and I remember when your platform first came out, you were very much deployed on Docker, and I would suspect that's possibly because Kubernetes didn't have quite the groundswell as it does have today. But I'm assuming you're not entirely dependent on Kubernetes, that you could run on any container platform. It just so happens that Kubernetes is the current one of choice.
Well, indeed. I think what we've seen is, you know, over the last couple of years is that Kubernetes has certainly won the mindshare and the market share for the orchestrator market. The Docker EE product is indeed based on Kubernetes. The Mesosphere product is moved to Kubernetes. The Pivotal products have moved to Kubernetes. And we kind of see, you know, all the market leaders like Red Hat OpenShift and based on Kubernetes, as well as the Rancher platforms, for example, based on Kubernetes. And of course, you know, we mustn't forget the big announcements by VMware providing their Kubernetes engines, as well as, of course, all the cloud providers providing managed Kubernetes services. So, you know, it's hard to avoid doing Kubernetes if you want to do cloud native. Kubernetes is probably that single focal point that's driving the cloud native movement forward.
Yeah. So Martin, from your perspective, how do you look at it and think of it, this in terms of the ability for the application to tell the storage what it wants? Seems like this is a bit more advanced than we've ever been able to do with, say, shared storage.
It is. I do have some questions about whether application developers and application teams often know what their storage wants or needs. So it's how that gets defined and how they need to still talk to people who understand a bit more about storage, because you find that application developers often have one or two ways to think about this. So they either want as much storage for as little as possible, or they want the fastest possible storage. So I still see, I think a lot of people see this as infrastructure people will get out the way, you're not needed anymore. But I still think there's quite a nuanced discussion to be had with application teams and service teams about how we deploy this and how you use your storage going forward.
So I'd like to just chime in on that. That's a really good point. I mean, we're seeing now more than ever before developers and DevOps teams getting involved in some of the storage discussions that you know, typically they wouldn't be involved in, because infrastructure teams would have, you know, a set number of standards that they would support, and the developers would be expected to use those standards. So that's certainly something that's changing. And in fact, one of the things that we've worked on at the CNCF as part of the storage SIG is we've created this sort of storage landscape white paper that kind of explains different attributes that you might want to consider when you're thinking about storage requirements. So, you know, performance is obviously one of them, and availability, but also scale and latency and durability and how the storage is instantiated and all of those sorts of things, and how the storage is managed and how the storage is integrates with the rest of your environment. So these are all important points in the decision process. And you know, storage is not easy. It really is one of those strong computer science problems, especially distributed storage, right? So it's hard to expect everybody to understand all of this. So good expertise is still needed.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's always going to be complicated, but you know, things are changing significantly. And on that note, why don't we get on and talk about what you're doing within version 2 of the platform? And let's try and understand what some of the new features are. And I'm guessing that some of the features we're likely to talk about are going to come from some of your understanding of how customers are looking to use the storage. So where should we start in terms of what version 2 actually has within it?
Version 2 is a significant change to StorageOS. Just over a year ago now, we started looking at what the trends in the marketplace were looking like. And we kind of saw that there were a few things happening. One is obviously, you know, Kubernetes became the de facto standard, but we also saw environments getting more complex and more hybridized. So people weren't deploying entirely in the cloud or entirely on-prem, and they were using different platforms. And also they weren't moving entire applications wholesale. Very often parts of an application lived on existing infrastructure and new parts of an application were being put in cloud-native environments. And then another change that we were seeing was that in the Kubernetes space, there was kind of this expectation that customers would deploy really large clusters and have sort of a number of applications or projects share those clusters. And certainly that is the case in some cases, but what we've seen as a general trend is that more and more customers are deploying a larger number of smaller clusters. And what this means is that it kind of changes the dynamics of what a storage system needs to look like, because the clusters are getting bigger and more complex and need to scale, but also the clusters need to talk to each other and the clusters need to hybridize. So with that in mind, we kind of looked at this and said, okay, how are we going to get the reliability and the functionality that customers are expecting in these extremely dynamic environments where, you know, there can be glitches where you have, say, a network glitch or a server glitch that takes a node offline for a short period of time or perhaps a long period of time.
Just to interrupt there, Alex, and I guess you probably, when you were designing your solution in the first place, we're assuming that we would see many, many nodes, many, many separate instances of the operating system or the storage OS operating system running. So your sort of resiliency and other things would be improved by that scale-out nature of solutions. But it sounds to me like you're saying that that's not what you're seeing people do.
Yes and no. We're seeing scale increase, but we're also seeing the scale of change increase, right?
Right.
So scale improves redundancy as long as there isn't correlation between the things that can fail. So, you know, it's having a scale of many nodes is great, but if they're all connected via a similar switch or something like that, then you still end up with the issues where you can have kind of a correlated change that creates a large blast radius to a failure scenario. So when we looked at this, we kind of said, okay, how do we solve this problem? Because with a distributed control plane and a distributed data plane, the complexity is large. And, you know, these are serious computer science problems that are hard to address. So one of the things we came out with was this concept of a mini brain. Effectively, each storage OS volume has its own smart mini brain that allows placement but also recovery decisions to happen independently of other nodes in a cluster. And what this means in real life is that it dramatically improves the reliability of the environment, because now even if nodes get partitioned, we can still make sensible decisions without some sort of monolithic control plane having to be able to talk to all the nodes within a cluster. But it also has some other functionality. So by implementing these mini brains, we get the concept of distributed redundancy and better availability during those complex failures. But it also means that we get better bandwidth and better scale, because we're not going through single choke points to make routing decisions or data convergence decisions. And then just one step on top of that, we've added the concept of what we're calling delta sync, which is the ability for volumes to rapidly converge. So when nodes fail and they come back, or when new replicas need to be provisioned, we can dramatically improve the speed at which those reconvergences happen. And this is important because we want to maintain deterministic performance. So in all of these cases, we need to remember our traditional use cases are things like databases or message queues, which kind of mean that you need low latency, but you need deterministic low latency. And as these changes happen with a cluster, you need to be able to maintain the same sort of speed. So for example, you know, we can often reconverge volumes when a node blips or a network has an issue within milliseconds as opposed to seconds or minutes. And that means that applications continue to see a consistent deterministic performance.
Okay, I mean, I think that's really interesting. I just want to get Martin's opinion on that, because one of the things, I guess, from anybody who's been in this industry for any length of time, as you have been, Alex, obviously, is that understanding of how the containerized environment is changing and how effectively storage is going to have to change to match it. Now, Martin, I was just thinking that whole idea of moving to smaller clusters, and many of them, is a potential scenario that developers probably want, because it means they all get their own cluster, but it directly has an issue on the way that you deploy the storage with that.
Yeah, it directly has an impact on how you deploy clusters or deploy your infrastructure for not just for storage. It has impacts on how you share data between different applications. Obviously, a smaller cluster means you have smaller numbers of potentially of disks, so a disk failure itself can be much more impactful, but it also allows you to constrain some things. So if you have a smaller cluster and you have a cluster which is aimed very much at a development group, it means that we can help minimize the impact of noisy neighbors, for instance. So, and as Alex said, it allows us to manage a lot more deterministic performance environment for people. It means that one rogue application can't actually impact everybody else.
That's the first thing then, Alex. So continue with what you were saying in terms of, you know, features, because I think you've got an answer to that, and you've got a comment on what Martin just said.
That's right. So the other concept that all of these little mini brains gives us is the ability to be much more flexible when we're talking about, for example, federated access between clusters. So V2 is going to enable us to provide a very rich roadmap between the way data is shared across clusters and across different platforms and environments. And this gives us a really strong capability of being able to deal with these environments, you know, as these environments mature.
That's the first thing then. This whole idea of more resiliency, more matching to the workloads and so on. What else can we expect in version 2?
The other thing that we've implemented is a strong security by default. So again, what we've seen is people are deploying Kubernetes, and Kubernetes, you know, does have a learning curve. It's easy to get things wrong. And therefore, what we wanted to make sure is that when deploying Storage OS, everything is secure by default. So we now automatically provide built-in certificate authorities that certify and authorize the access across all the API endpoints, as well as all the data path elements within Storage OS. And we've implemented security in depth for even things like the security around the CSI access points and things like that, so that effectively now Kubernetes is using authenticated and certified connectivity into Storage OS for all the functionality. On top of that, we've implemented encryption by default for all the data that's in transit. So we don't use unencrypted connections anywhere within the product. And again, some of these things were things that you could do with the V1 product, but maybe you had to do them by hand. But we're taking away all of that complexity and making it secure by default now.
Okay, I mean, I'd say a lot of what you've said so far, in terms of, especially around the security side, is typically what you would expect if you were going into an enterprise environment. It sounds like there's a lot more focus on delivering features that the enterprise are going to be coming knocking on your door for anyway. So the more you can build those in from day one and make them literally, you know, part of the product that you don't even have to think about, I guess it makes your solution more and more enterprise attractive.
That's right. So, you know, Storage OS has quite a large community adoption. We've had over 3,000 clusters installed now since we went GA just over a year and a bit ago. The customers that are adopting Kubernetes, as you would expect, are typically the customers or the verticals that are further along in product maturity cycles. So we're seeing strong adoption in financial services, service providers, and life sciences, for example. And yes, of course, in all of those environments, things like, you know, reliability and security are incredibly important tick boxes that are both valued and required by the internal organizations before they adopt any new software.
Martin, I think makes common sense, doesn't it? I mean, that's one of the things with our background, and well, Alex as well, because we've known Alex for a long time, but from our background in the enterprise, that these are the sort of things that are expected to be table stakes in traditional products. So anything that's coming along from a software perspective is going to have to deliver to the same requirements.
Yeah, so you've got the basic security requirements and now encryption of data at rest and data in flight is becoming table stakes. This wasn't really the case 3 or 4 years ago in most environments. It's only recently that encryption has become absolutely key for your data. Manageability at scale. I do have a question for Alex. So this is version 2. So how do you go from version 1 to version 2? Because there's an interesting comment which I've seen flying around about Kubernetes in general, which kind of compares it to OpenStack. Lots of people actually had a pretty good OpenStack environment, but when it came to upgrade it, that's why OpenStack is now dying, because it's a nightmare to upgrade. So Kubernetes itself could actually have some of the same issues, but what about your product going from V1 to V2? Is it a in-place upgrade? Is it non-disruptive? So all sort of things which enterprise customers expect to see.
So that's a really good point. And certainly what we're seeing is as Kubernetes matures, the upgrade processes are certainly becoming easier and automated. So I'll just speak a little bit about Kubernetes and I'll speak a little bit about StorageOS. So in the Kubernetes world, we're kind of seeing both managed service providers, but also the distributions moving to sort of what they're calling immutable operating systems. And we're seeing this across a number of the different service providers now. And what that means is that effectively, when you have a managed Kubernetes cluster, you upgrade by effectively throwing away a node and adding a new node with a new version to the cluster. And this is, while not quite a non-disruptive process, it is an in-place process, right? Where applications and data gets drained from nodes and nodes get replaced on a rolling basis. When it comes to StorageOS, we've invested quite a lot of work into this concept called an operator, which is a Kubernetes construct that effectively automates the work that a traditional sysadmin, I guess, would be responsible for. And that includes things like, for example, you know, removing nodes, adding nodes to the cluster, scaling the cluster, but also the upgrade process. So similar to that, with StorageOS, there is an upgrade process. Upgrading from version 1 to version 2 involves a couple of steps, but they're looking to be automated through an in-place upgrade too.
So that all sounds great, but I'm really interested to understand what exactly you're finding from the customers that you have and what their experiences are. Because you said earlier that there were 3,000 clusters out there. With that many environments out there, you must be getting some good information about what are you seeing customers do and what successes are they having with the platform?
So we're seeing quite a wide variety of adoption, as you can imagine. Everything from, you know, small developer-focused instances to mid-sized projects to larger environments. Some of the more interesting environments and customers we're working with involve, for example, a financial services trading platform that is being rolled out to a number of different banking systems right now, where StorageOS is providing sort of both availability and trade processing capabilities for these really large financial services organizations. We're also seeing adoption in life science environments, where there is kind of a strong mix between analytics, but also the data services that are used by researchers. And we're also seeing, you know, some really innovative, more complex workloads for example, I'll give you two examples. One is a case where users have a very sophisticated CI/CD environment, which involves fairly complex workflows and lots of regular updates where we where this particular customer actually creates and deletes something like 3,000 volumes a day as part of their workflow. And we're also seeing more complex environments with, for example, another trading firm that's using StorageOS to actually create multiple copies of data that are used for different analytics and different batch requirements at different points in the day too. So it's everything from, you know, the mundane to and more traditional, but we're also seeing the types of workloads that can only happen with these type of cloud native environments. So for example, you know, the vast majority of traditional arrays, for example, would seriously struggle to create and delete thousands of volumes on a daily basis.
I find that interesting, and Martin, you probably got a better angle on this than I have, because you actually have you have people working for you and I don't. But I find it interesting that Alex is almost sort of pointing out that the sort of use cases that he's seeing, which are the interesting ones, are the ones where storage is becoming part of the actual workflow process rather than just being a place to keep your data. And I think that is a really interesting sort of use of the technology.
We've seen storage, certainly in our world, I mean, storage is part of the workflow process. So it's absolutely key of how we move content around and what we do with content as you work on it. It's not just somewhere we store data. We do have large amounts of data stores, but this concept of workflow storage has become absolutely key to the way we deal with content in our business.
Yeah,
and do you think that's like the majority, Alex, of what you're seeing out there? That we're seeing an evolution of the way that people are developing apps into applications and solutions that really have that workload requirement, and therefore the traditional storage just simply won't be able to match those requirements.
I think that's right. I think for some of these use cases, traditional storage just can't keep up with those rates of change, for example. But also, it is about the type of changes that Kubernetes and orchestrators in general bring to an environment, right? So the whole concept of having composable infrastructure or declarative way of describing what your infrastructure needs to look like really does change the whole aspect of how people consume infrastructure. Because one of the things we've been considering is what's driving the adoption of all of these things. And I think, you know, we have this concept that cloud came along and started providing the ability to have infrastructure on demand. But actually, you know, in our thinking, cloud isn't actually a place. What it's done is it's created a set of behavioral models that people want to adopt. So end users want to have a switch on, switch off consumption model. They want to have self-service. They want to have automation on deployment. They want to have automation around operational processes too. And so what we're kind of seeing is every layer of the stack, whether it's, you know, compute or storage or networking, operates to provide these dynamic services, because end users want to be able to say, this is my application, this is what it needs, and they just want the thing to just work. They don't want to have to go through and configure everything by hand. So as we move to those sort of environments, we're going to see, you know, a change in focus, where rather than previously focusing on the complexities of how you configure your infrastructure, application developers can now focus on, well, their actual application.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the way that we saw, for instance, first VMware and then the cloud allow us to just say, give me a VM, which, you know, effectively was give me an environment to write my application into. And even more so when we saw that move with containers, I think the fact that you can just say, give me an asset to do some work with, storage shouldn't be treated any differently. And it's now that workflow that's being driven much quicker with containers that's forcing that. I think that's a really key message for people to think of going forward.
I think we're in a very interesting time when we're recording this. We're obviously in the middle of the coronavirus crisis, and it would be really nice for a lot of the larger end users to be able to redefine our infrastructure and redeclare it without a massive amount of extra work. So you could actually almost have a pandemic declared infrastructure, which may change your application mix and what applications spin up. But most of us don't have that at the moment, so we're trying to do things by hand. And if we had a much more mature orchestration environment which was ready to go, there was a whole load of stuff which could have been done a lot more quickly. And I think the current crisis is actually going to drive some of these changes and reinforce what people are trying to do.
Yeah, agreed. I don't think we should be looking at things and thinking the adversity side of it. We should be thinking of the positive side of the fact that inevitably this is an evolution, but it just might be an evolution that's being pushed a bit faster because of where we stand.
Well, today, actually, I saw an interesting tweet from somebody who they were suggesting a new survey for companies of what's driven your digital transformation, your CEO, your CIO, or COVID-19.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so Alex, if people want to go and find out about the technology, go and try it out, understand what platforms it's supported on, just generally, you know, get that next stage into understanding how to use this and mess about with it, and then even consider putting it into production, how would they go about doing that?
So that's really easy. The first point of call is the website at storageos.com. There you can find all the documentation as well as the software. The software is available for free on Docker Hub and other registries, and it is just a container. One of the nice things about StorageOS is we don't have any particular dependencies, so anywhere you can install a container, you can install StorageOS. We currently support all of the major distributions and the major managed service providers, including things like OpenShift and Rancher, as well as EKS and AKS and Google, etc. The easiest way to try the software is to follow the self-eval guide. The software is available on a freemium model. What this means is that effectively your first 500 gig are available for free, and then the rest of the software is available on a subscription basis.
So obviously that now means that version 2 is available, so people can go and actually download and try out version 2 of the software?
That's right. Version 2 is available, and all the documentation for version 2 is available on docs.storageos.com.
Fantastic. Well, Alex, thanks for joining us. I think it's been really interesting. There's some very thought-provoking pieces there around how we're going to adopt technology like this going forward as part of the way that we develop applications and so on. And I appreciate you coming on. Thanks very much for your time, and look forward to catching up with you soon.
Thank you, Chris, and thank you, Martin. This has been a great conversation.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked, or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.